Hi there.
Hi there, and Happy New Year. Can we still say that? I know that's a Larry David joke.
Well, so, there's a whole thing on Curb Your Enthusiasm. If you watch Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David, he has this whole thing, whole spiel where he's like, no, you're too late. Like, I think 3 days after New Year's is the last time you can say Happy New Year to someone. After that, you're too late.
Not here. It is really just the beginning of winter, because winter starts December 21st or 22nd.
Yeah.
Or started, because we are recording this on December 19th. Yes.
2021. But it will be 2022 when you hear it or see it.
This is Silhouettes JB Podcast. Hello, everybody. I am Gia. It's
JB Podcast. Thank you, Nick and Desi Dramard.
Yes. And what's your name?
My name is DeV.
Where did that come from? Wrong show. This is in Oklahoma.
Well, it's, you know, when they're playing to the guy with no nose, you know, they're in the mm-hmm. place where you fly over to get to LA.
Yes.
So it's in like one of those, you know.
I like being in that niche.
Yeah, exactly. This is the niche. That's where we are. So I'm the V.
Okay. Well, we're also going somewhere where you have to fly several thousand.
Fly down under.
Correct, because today we are continuing our final diversification in different guests
forays
that we have
into
on
the
our show.
International worlds of Jersey Boys.
Exactly. And we are going to Australia today.
Zoom studio in Australia.
It's our first interview with any creative in Australia. We're so excited.
Yeah. We got Thomas Armstrong Robley in the Zoom studio, who is not only playing Tommy DeVito in Jersey Boys at the Star on the Gold Coast in Australia, but he is also directing this production of Jersey Boys. And this is the second production of Jersey Boys he has done. And he'll tell us more about the first time he did it when he comes on.
Yes, and he's already accomplished so much too, because if you have to go on their Instagram, it's just called Jersey Boys Musical, and they have had one-on-one interviews with each season. So for example, Thomas is playing Tommy. Get it? Tom. Very cool. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom, you hungry? They started with Daniel Reichert, who was interviewed by the gentleman playing Bob Gaudio in that production. Then they did, and then John Lloyd Young. Mm-hmm. It was John, then Daniel, and then just recently Thomas interviewed Christian.
Yes.
And now tomorrow
with our friend J. Robert Spencer.
Yeah, and their Nikki will be interviewing J. Robert Spencer. It's going to be
And that is the first time that all four of the original, like, four seasons from the show have actually participated in some interview process for another.
Yeah. Gig, like close proximity, you know?
Yeah.
And so Thomas was actually born in England and he grew up in Australia, and Thomas trained at the Queensland Conservatorium of Music. He has performed in leading roles in shows such as The Phantom of the Opera, where he was the Phantom alternate and understudied Raoul. He was Kinnicky in Grease.
Woo!
He was Roger in Rent, and most recently, the Pirate King in Gilbert and Sullivan's The Pirates of Penzance. And he has performed with orchestras and pops orchestras all over the AU. It's the coolest thing when you just perform with an orchestra. That's like one of the coolest things.
Yes. Oh my gosh. That's a dream for sure. And so I'm really excited to really delve into his directorial work. And he's directed Into the Woods, Cinderella, the Pantomime. I have no idea what that is, but I can't wait to talk about that with him. He directed Grease as well, and Pirates of the Penzance was revised.
Pirates of Penzance.
What did I say?
Pirates of the Penzance.
Of the Penzance?
Pirates of Penzance.
I always say it wrong. I don't know why. I'm so sorry. Okay. And he also earned 20 awards. That's
for
incredible.
Like a Metaphor, mm-hmm. the production of Like a Metaphor for the 2015-2016 Queensland Drama Festival circuit, including a nomination for Best Director.
Congratulations. Yes. And what we think is one of the coolest things about Thomas is that he developed not one, not two, not three, but five concert cabaret shows. And one of them, of course, is a all around Frankie concert. So it's called Live at Frankie's, the songs of Valley and Sinatra. And his concerts span over different genres of music. So you have classic rock, you have different stage and film music, you have soul, Motown, and disco. So he's all over the map, just like we are, and we love it. So we're really excited to talk about somebody who has that mind, who kind of spans different decades. And we just can't wait to talk about everything with him and really get his perspective from Australia. So please, without further ado, welcome Thomas
Armstrong-Robley. Welcome.
What's going on, guys? There we are. Welcome to Australia.
Welcome. We are happy to be down under. So before we go any further, can you please tell us the names of the gentlemen who will be playing the other seasons alongside with you in Jersey Boys?
We have an amazing cast. Like, I think all four of us were overseas when COVID hit. And so we've all come home. So this is now home for us. So playing Frankie Valli is Bryn Jahnke. Now Bryn actually just won an award for portraying Frankie Valli in another production. So he is now insisted, no, he hasn't, that I call him the award-winning Bryn Jahnke at all times.
Very nice.
So he'll walk into a rehearsal with a coffee, you know, first thing in the morning, and you'll go, "Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the award-winning Bryn Jahnke." we have Jack Saunders, who's an amazing, multi-talented musician, triathlete, and singer. He plays he plays Bob Gaudio, and then, believe it or not, the guy that was sitting in London with me when COVID hit, you know, we were drinking cider in Regent's Park, wondering what was next for us, called Elliot Baker. He's an amazing, he's a comedian. He's got the most gorgeous baritone voice and comes from a long line of classical singers, and he's playing Nick.
Ooh, I wonder how he's going to do the towels.
Oh yeah. That's like, it's such a, I think that, and I, we'd love to talk about that moment with you as a director, as well as an actor, you know, you know, further on in the interview, we'd love to talk to you about that. But that monologue is just so dramatically comedic, you know. Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
So we'll definitely get into that later on.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And we're glad that you're back home in Australia. So you were in London the whole time?
I was, believe it or not, I left Australia, surprisingly late in, what was it, 2020? No, where are we? Yeah, 2020. So I actually had left Australia in 2020 to join Norwegian Spirit for what I believed was going to be 3 weeks. 3 weeks turned into 2 months at sea. And then, you know, I thought from there it would be a case of fly back to Australia. Unfortunately, there was no safe routes for me to fly back to Australia. Because, you know, it would mean going through 5 or 6 different airports, which in the midst of this huge pandemic, and we didn't know anything about it at the time. So it just wasn't safe. So fortunately, I'm a UK citizen as well. So I just went back to England thinking, you know, a couple of months back to work. That didn't happen. 8 months later, I was still sitting in London, twiddling my thumbs, and, you know, some good stuff happened, like a podcast and things like that. But for the most part, I was still very much wondering, when am I going to get back on stage? What do I do?
Well, thank God for that podcast pivot, because none of us would be talking right now.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes. Well, please continue to stay safe. So for everybody listening to this, like, we are recording this in late December, December 19th, and things are really crazy right now in New York City. Jersey Boys actually canceled their performances this weekend on the 18th and 19th. Yeah. So we're praying that everything's going to be okay. And of course, for your show, which is January 6th through the 16th, that all is smooth and under control. So we're wishing you all the best.
You can't keep that. You can't hold the Jersey Boys down. You cannot. Never. You cannot stop us. We will be on that stage. I promise you.
Absolutely.
Yes. Absolute. So we'd love to get to know a little bit more about you. So your early years, as we like to call it. So you were born in England. And so please tell us, what was it like, how you grew up, and when did you catch the music and the theater bug?
So, I was in England till I was, I think I moved to Australia at the age of 8. So, you know, very early years was England, page 1 to 43, I think we'll call it. If we were going by the script. Little Jersey Boys humor for you there. I grew up there and, you know, I was still very much in the, it was just primary school and things like that. So I did one show in the UK as a kid. And I think I was pushed into that drama class as a way of, you know, I was a kid that liked to dress up. You know, I would take a black bin bag or a bin liner, or I don't know if you guys put the bin,
a trash bins. Bag.
Trash bag, yeah, yeah. And I would cut a hole in the neck and then put a pair of boots on with it, and oh, I'm a musketeer or whatever.
That's it.
That kind of kid. So I think my mom saw that and pushed me into drama class as a kind of way of shifting some of that creative energy. I wasn't really engaged with it. And I think even in the early years of me getting to Australia in 2002, I was doing drama, but I was very much the sports kid. And it wasn't until high school when I kind of faced that High School Musical-esque crossroads where I had, and this is a true story. I had the grand final of my soccer. I was the captain of the team and I was the goalkeeper. So pretty important. Mm-hmm. And yes, I also had the final dress rehearsal of the first musical I was playing a lead in, which was The Wiz. And I had to choose. And mm-hmm. I chose musical theater. And that is kind of how it ended up. So yeah.
Wow. All right, Trey Bolden.
yeah, good. Nice. Yeah.
Wow, isn't it crazy those defining moments that you have in life? And that's what we talk about a lot with Jersey Boys, of course, you know, because I feel like for us, like High School Musical was definitely my introduction to everything, dance, musical theater, film, the whole thing. That was also in 2006, the year Jersey Boys won the Tony. So that's full circle. But the whole show is about those defining moments. And you know, the older we get and the more of those moments that we have, everything really can be broken down into one scene or one line or one movement of blocking in Jersey Boys. So when you first watch the show, like what things in your life were you going through and what things kind of came to mind?
So I was freshly 18 when I first saw Jersey Boys. I saw Jersey Boys July of 2012. It was John Lloyd Young's first night back up. He was coming back for 8 weeks. And I had no idea what the show was about. I mean, I'd grown up, as I said, in England. So Bye Bye Baby, which was one of the few songs that I really recognized, was a Bay City Rollers hit. Right. For me, that was their song. It wasn't the Four Seasons. I'd heard Begging through, you know, different, you know, versions of that. And same with Oh What a Night. I was familiar with the disco arrangement of it, but not necessarily the Four Seasons. And I just remember going into the show and being so blown away with how much of the repertoire I actually knew. And, you know, you immediately become a fan. It's impossible not to, because you're being educated through this through this amazing, amazing show. And I remember, you know, looking back now, I'm not appreciating at the time the talent that I saw on that stage. Like, as I said, John, but also Andy Carl as Tommy, you know, like, wow, what a cast. I remember it was so funny. And we were talking about the towel sequence a second ago. I remember there was a line dropped and I remember being aware enough that something had dropped. And I don't think anyone in the audience would have, but I think because I'd done quite a few like community musicals up to that point, I was aware enough that I could notice when a line was dropped. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember, again, I can't remember off the top of my head who was playing Nick. So obviously
it was Matt Bogart.
Yeah. And I don't even know if it was his line, but I just remember there being a moment of something's gone wrong here. But then eventually the show rolled on, and I was probably the only one out of, you know, however many seats that the August Wilson Theatre held that probably noticed. But yeah, it's fascinating that I still remember that moment after all these years.
Wow. No, absolutely. I know. Well, it's definitely one of those Disney collectible moments, as we talk about. Yeah, because every show is a different story. Every production is different. But okay, so you were 18 when you saw it. You're only about 2.5 years older than we are. And you've been crazy busy. So I love that you've been creating like different concerts and cabarets like for yourself and for, you know, your colleagues. But how have you had the time to go through all of that plus your other productions? Because at least in the States, it's very rare for us to be able to do all of those things before 28.
It's interesting. I guess like I studied from 2014 to 2016 at the conservatorium. And I think, you know, for me, day one at the con was the day that I started looking for work after the con, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, of course.
So I think, whereas I think a lot of people that I know started, you wait till third year and then you think, okay, what now? I was thinking what now before I even, you know, stepped through the doors at the university, because at the end of the day, it was more about, it's always about, you know, how do I become the most employable, the most valuable artist I possibly can be. And I think I've always been a person that, you know, never, I won't take no for an answer when it comes to, you know, my work. If there's no work for me, which in Australia, a lot of the time there is no work for you, because there is, I suppose, a lack of big touring productions. We don't have national tours of, you know, every musical that's on Broadway. We have so limited in terms of the amounts of theaters that go around. And also we don't have what I would call a revolving door audience. Because no one is coming to Australia necessarily just for destination theatre. You wouldn't travel to Queensland just to see a musical. Now, the odd person might, but certainly not enough to maintain a show for years and years and years and years and years. So for me, the writing was on the wall that, you know, I was going to have to create my own work to sustain me. And, you know, looking at things like cruise ships and, you know, I was always, as much as I love musical theatre, I knew that the way to back to musical theatre was going to be through establishing myself as a solo and, you know, mm-hmm. and try to create concepts that made me really attractive to, you know, cruise lines, to agents, to theatres that could, you know, really pay my bills. And then through the reputation I would gain because of that, you know, because of, you know, you go overseas, you work and you do these concerts, you can then credit yourself as an international concert artist, which is, right. You know, and then immediately you're more valuable back in Australia. So it wasn't necessarily that I necessarily wanted to leave Australia and, you know, and make a living elsewhere. It felt like a necessity, if that makes sense, to just kind of to make it happen. And I suppose, like the seasons, it's you're not defined by how much talent you have. You know, I've been very upfront with everybody I talk to. I don't consider myself the most talented guy in the world. There's people that can sing higher notes. There's people that can dance better steps. There's people that can take that guitar off the wall and do something like a prodigy with it. I'm not that guy, but I'll work harder than anybody mm-hmm. and make it happen, which is, I think, why I relate to Tommy so much, which we'll get into, like, because he was that guy too.
Yeah, of course. So, well, I love that story. And I think it's so inspiring that you really do hit the ground running all the time. And you're always learning and studying, especially with the range of music that you've worked on. So mm-hmm. We were watching your interview with Christian Hoff. Congratulations on that awesome achievement, by the way.
I just want to say right up front, we did not plan to wear hats. Like, we just turned
the camera on. I was going to ask you that.
And we looked so in sync. And I was like, this is spooky, but what a cool guy.
Yeah, he is the coolest.
He's really cool.
Yes. And that means that you're doing something right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he is. Yeah. So we've had the pleasure of meeting Christian Hoff through our associate producer, Howard Tucker. And yeah, so we met him at a show and he's the sweetest guy.
Sweetheart. Yeah. Always wearing a hat.
Yep.
Always wearing a hat?
It's funny. This hat actually has that's real flat. this hat actually has a story. So I did I used to teach three brothers, 17. Well, I mean, they get older now, but they're about a year apart, each of them. And I've done a number of, I'm heavily connected with a local theater company here that runs a performance academy for young kids. And that was where kind of I got my start. So I always keep my toe dipped in there mm-hmm. because, you know, I'm very thankful to them for everything they've done for me in my early years. Anyway, this hat was a gift. I was asked to come and lead the company of School of Rock earlier in the year. So I was kind of brought in as a professional artist to work with, you know, with community kids and which was an amazing role, hell of a hard role. But
you played Dewey?
I played Dewey, yeah, nice. Which was the hardest role that I've ever played on stage. Really? It's a killer. It's a killer. And we were doing like tech week. I did 9 runs of the show, which is great. Like, yeah, it was nuts. Like much more intense than the Broadway schedule, like because the seasons are so packed. But anyway, this hat was a gift from the family who I dubbed on stage. They're called the Van Stams, and on stage in a concert years ago, these kids were doing a cabaret, and I introduced them as the three members of the Van Stam gang. And that little joke has kind of become an opening opening night of the show. They handed me this bag and said, "You're now an honorary member of the Van Stam gang," and because they all wear this kind of hat as well. So it's got a meaning behind it, and it just looks cool as hell.
There you go. Yeah. Sweet. Well, what a stylish gang. That's so fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
a crazy story about School of Rock. Alex Brightman, who originated the role on Broadway, said insane. He said he couldn't take a nap in between shows on a two-show day because it would take him like 4 hours to warm up.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
He used to get up, and you can ask my partner about this. I used to do the same. I would have to get up. I used to get up 4 to 5 hours. I get up 3 hours before I sing anyway, but 4 hours before the show, I would go for probably a 5 to 10 kilometer walk. I would just like naturally, you know, have to just, there'd be a regimen in my dressing room. I would have this bottle, which is a liter and a half. I'd have one of these filled with water. I'd have another one with 2 Barocca, 2 Hydralyte. Just in Act 1, just to replace the fluid you lose. I'd have lozenges already unwrapped, ready to go, because you're never off stage in that first act. And then even in Act 2, it's the most testing role I've ever had. I was at the physio every week, you know, not because I was injured, just for maintenance, you know. It was just, and it was just, and the whole cast really, they put you on their shoulders and they help you through it. Like, I've never felt love from a cast before like that. I had such a regimen, like a military regimen. Like, I'd have a banana between each in the middle of Act 1 and Act 2. That was just like to keep my energy levels up. I'd have I'd eat the same meal before every show. I'd meal prep the same thing. So like, you just become, it just becomes science, you know, how you know what's going to get you through it.
In Jersey Boys, in the Dodgers productions, they have very specifically and strategically placed water bottles and fluids for Frankie to be able to drink on stage.
Yeah.
So I saw you posted on your Instagram that you went to go see the Toxic Avenger in the West End a few years back. I played Melvin a few years ago. Also, definitely the hardest role I've ever had to play. I had like 5 water bottles placed at different parts of the set. I also did a lot of the same things that you had to do for Dewey. I did for Melvin. It was just, but when you actually do it, and then when you take your bow and curtain call, and you see not only the audience, you hear the roar from them, but you see everyone around you, you feel that love from them. It's just like, wow, I did that, and I have this amazing cast, amazing support system.
I think the kids helped as well, big time. Like you are on stage there, and obviously in the first act, a bit of a bad boy and stuff like that. But you are like, you're a god to these kids. Like, you're a hero, I don't think they understood how much they got me through it. Like, they probably looked at me and were like, "Wow, we couldn't do the show without you." But I honestly could not have done that show without them. Like, they literally gave me the life to get through it, because it was just it's such a slog. It's like every song has the bottom of your high notes are like G's, and then it's up to C's in some numbers. It's crazy.
Where is your, it's so funny, I asked this question to a lot of people, but not really a lot of people, to a select few people I've asked this question to. Where is your passaggio, you would say?
It depends. It depends show to show. If it's a rock show, it's one thing. If it's a legit show, it's another thing. I'll say this. Every show I do, and it's changed. It's funny, because after years of shifts, my passaggio has changed. It used to be above just above G, you know, that would be where I'd start to get a little bit of trouble.
Like G sharp.
But then with the crazy. And then, you know, that A flat I used to struggle with a little bit. And then that was kind of, it was inconsistent. Like that would be sometimes there and sometimes not there. But then now comfortably an A every day of the week.
Beautiful.
And then, beautiful. And then, and, but then I was surprising myself in School of Rock. You're floating up to those B's in Stick to the Man. That's just B and A, B and A, B and A. And then even in, there's that, the, you're in the band Reprise, which floats up to a C. He says, but then I've always had the crazy falsetto as well. So like the my first job overseas was singing the Frankie part in a Jersey Boys tribute. And so that's tones, always been there.
Right.
Yeah. That's always been there. It's just, I've built my, the top part of my chest voice has moved upwards as well, which is, it makes sense. Beautiful. As your voice matures and, you know, you become a lot more employable because those A's and G's and those B's, they're the money makers for
those are the money makers. Those are like that in Santa Fe from Newsies. I ain't got nothing if I ain't got Santa Fe. If you can sing that, you're golden.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, silence is not golden. Those bees are golden.
Silence.
Very good. Very good.
All right, okay. Quiz. We'd like to give you a little pop quiz.
Already?
Okay.
Already. Pop quiz. Where does Silence is Golden play in Jersey Boys?
In the underscore.
Oh, I do know because I was working this scene the other day. In the, is it the bar between Lorraine and Frankie?
And what other Candy song is playing in that same scene?
Dawn.
This guy, this guy's good. He's good. We like the under, this guy.
The underscore is, the transition is so beautiful. Like,
yeah, once Nick comes back in, Candy Girl is in the diner.
Yeah. Candy Girl underscores the scene between Bobby and Frankie, which is just, again, such a, one of my favorite songs. I just think it's absolutely beautiful. Stunning. I wish it was in there. Yeah. I wish we got to perform it. I wish.
Yeah, me too. So how did you get to know the catalog of Frankie Valli in the first season?
I think I saw the show for the first time and then, you know, you just become fan. And again, I think a lot of the extensive repertoire was by necessity of it was my first job overseas. And you know, I really tested myself. I hadn't really tested my falsetto before that job, but I was up for the show and I put in a request. I said I'd like to sing the Frankie part because I knew with that would come the leadership of the group, which is what I wanted, which is what I wanted to kind of be, you know, you want to be in front.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense.
Did you audition wanting to be Frankie first?
I auditioned wanting to do, so I wrote myself a list. It was New Year's Eve of 2016, heading into 2017. And I did a show in Mackay, which is about an hour's flight north of Brisbane. So I spent New Year's in my apartment by myself. So I decided to write myself a list of goals. And the top of my list was work overseas. So I was looking for every job that was overseas, knowing that I was coming straight out of uni, didn't have a lot of credits to my name. So I found this job that was working in Europe, doing like hotels, resorts, festivals, pubs, clubs, things like that, doing Four Seasons. And I was a fan of the Four Seasons. So I applied for the job. Wasn't specifying a particular role within that because obviously with a tribute, it's vocal parts. It's not, you're not like Frankie Tommy Pub, you know,
right,
obviously they called them, you know, so I was on what they called the falsetto part. But, you know, there was a few interesting experiences through that contract where, you know, you'd lose a guy because of sickness or something like that. So I would be singing the low, low parts of Blue Moon and the high, like, so you just, so it, but that I can tell you with all honesty, that was where my passaggio moved.
Wow.
Because that was an 8-month contract. We did 200 shows and like you're working like a lot, and your voice just, because you forget, you get out of your head, you're just doing it and you forget that, oh, I'm hitting these notes. Doesn't matter. You're just singing. And then all of a sudden you go to test your range and you're like, oh wow. Yeah. My range has gotten a lot bigger.
I think that's so, once you can get out of your head, that's the hat trick, right?
It's everything.
Yeah. When everything drops away. In other words,
it's finding out the note. Yeah. Finding out the note you sing after you've sung it is the magic. Like the first time I hit a C was in a vocal rehearsal for School of Rock. It was an optional C. You don't have to do it, but I hit it. And then the vocal director went, you just hit a C. I went, and it was 9 a.m. like I was I'd gotten up early and I'd warmed up, but it proved to me that it's not how many hours you warm up. It's just getting out of your head. Like, and you know, obviously correct placement and everything like that. But you know, I would, if I'd have known we were aiming for a C, I wouldn't hit it. But because I just let it, it was like, wow, okay, you just hit a C. And I'm like, okay, I'm good now. I don't need to do it anymore.
Was that a chested C or a mixed?
It was a chest. It was a short chested, you know, it was just flicked up to it, but it was.
Well, to bring the show back home, what made you want to do Jersey Boys, like, you know, while the everything was crazy with the pandemic? Like, why was that like a key show for you to do for next year? And what was the process of getting the rights to the show? Because that's something that we're very interested in worldwide.
So the story of this current Jersey Boys is very interesting. So I'll take you back a year if you indulge me. So I was sitting very much like I am now at a desk in London, and I was unemployed. I was working on little projects, but none that were putting money in my pocket, shall we say. London had just announced that we were going to go back into lockdown. It was Halloween, and I was just thinking, I need to get back to Australia. But you know, I knew how much it was going to cost me to get back to Australia. It ended up costing, I think, well over $5,000 for flights, and plus $3,000 for quarantine and things like that. So it was an expensive exercise, nearly wiped my bank account out. But I didn't want to come back to Australia and just go and work in an office. Now, this is me being a bit stubborn, I suppose. I'd worked for so many years to build up this career for myself that I didn't want to just throw it away. So it was very important. And I was getting pressure from certain people that, you know, oh, you just come back and just get a job. And, you know, I didn't want to do that. So I made some calls. As I said, I was connected with a local theater company who, you know, have always been there for me. So I called them and asked about doing some teaching work. So I said, look, I'd love to come back and be an acting tutor for you guys if you've got a place for me. In the same breath, they were looking for a director for Jersey Boys, which was coming to their my hometown theater, which is a beautiful 500-seat theater in Redcliffe. And they were looking for a director for that, which was in March of next year. So I immediately, obviously with my history with the music, I said, yep, I'm your man. And I didn't even question how much they were going to pay me. Like, I was just like, I needed something to come back to. And that was it. And it was just like, you know, the stars were in alignment.
There you go.
So I set out from London to put out the audition brief and get that set, but also to put myself a team together. My choreographer now, Jenny, had come back from Melbourne after many years of working and living there. And I was a guy that was auditioning who ended up playing Nick in that first production called Jeremy. And his father is been a musical director all over the world. And he'd been a conductor and a producer. And his background was in conferences and big like hotel expos and things like that overseas. So he was back in Australia because of COVID as well. So Jeremy had reached out to me asking some questions about the audition. And he said, by the way, who's your musical director? And I said, I'm still looking, because I was obviously still in Australia, so I wasn't able to do these meetings. So all my dad's won, and he said he'd love to help you out. He's looking for something to do as a project until he can get back overseas. So it was 2 a.m. in London. Robert called me, and we struck up a kinship, and we agreed on philosophical things regarding music and things like that.
Some ancillary rights.
I put him forward. And I put him forward for the project. And he actually, for that, being a professional musical director, he actually volunteered his time for that first production. And now he is the executive producer and musical director of this new professional production. So there's so many things that had I not done, there was a couple of people that had said no to being musical directors. Had they said yes, I'm not taking this little show to the casino now. So, the show in Redcliffe was so full of professionals and semi-pros because of COVID, and people were looking for a way to get back on stage after a year of inactivity, that, it was so above the standard of what was, I think, expected in this area. And as a result, we got the attention of the casino and of some financial backers and some people that went, let's really put some money into this. Let's redesign it. Let's take it up a level. Let's pay all the cast. Let's pay all the band. Let's get everyone. Let's create 40 jobs or more.
Yeah.
And so what started as this little project that I thought was going to end for me in March has now turned into a full-time job. And it just goes to show that, no matter what project you're working on, if you perceive it as a little small project, or put everything into it, because you don't know who's watching. And
exactly.
This has created not only this work for me now, which is satisfying me so creatively, but also financially supporting me, but also it's going to create a lot of work down the line. And to work in the beautiful Star Casino, which is, it's a perfect show for the casino. And it's just, I couldn't have imagined a year ago. It's funny, actually, and this is the best bit, and this kind of sums up this whole journey. A year ago on the I got back the beginning of December, I was at a place called Crown Plaza, which is a big hotel complex. That was where I did my hotel quarantine, which was a government mandated thing. Out my window, I could see the Star Casino, and I didn't know at the time I was looking at the future. Jersey Boys, which is amazing.
That's beautiful. Yes. So you were in Planet Twando, as Ron Belrose likes to call it. You really were. You were in the middle of the past, present, and the future. So that's beautiful.
It's a sign, Tommy.
Exactly. So, well, thank you for sharing that timeline with us. So now that the show has turned into a full-time job for you, we were watching your talk with Christian Hoff. Did you mention in there that you talked to Des Magunoff and he kind of give you pointers?
Obviously Christian has extensively. So,
right.
I mean, for me, I'm getting the information secondhand. I'd love to, of course. But I haven't. I'm always open to any conversations. I'll talk to anybody.
Well, so when it comes to directing this new production and really, just being at the forefront of it all, are there any changes that you've made creatively from the Dodgers production? And can you talk about any of them without giving too much away?
Absolutely. Happily to talk about. Yeah, it's a complete redesign. Imagination of the show follows the same amazing script, same amazing songs, but everything from the tracks in terms of the cast and the roles they play. So for example, our tracks don't follow the classic format that is on Broadway. We rebuild the tracks according to the person playing it, which allows for one ownership of one's track, but also you get the absolute best out of each person because you're not shoehorning a person's skill set into a particular track. We've built the track to the person. So nice. Obviously creates a lot more work onto me, but it also has yielded incredible results because that person is the first person to play that particular track. Same deal with the design. We play in a trapezoid. Our playing. Yeah, that's okay. If you're looking from the front, in fact, you know what? Wait there. I might have a drawing for you.
Please, just wait.
Exclusive. Just I haven't released these to anybody. Exclusive.
Thank you.
This is it, guys. Getting an exclusive.
Here we go.
Right here, right now.
So the West JV guest. That's what we do. We get the exclusives.
Waiter, one more set design photo, please.
Ooh, a trapezoid. Cool. Well, I love the fact that they fitted. They casted the tracks depending on on the actor. That's really cool. So right now Austin Owen as Bob Crewe plays the judge.
Right.
Maybe the actor who plays Jip is going to be the judge instead. Right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So this is an early concept drawing of the. I don't know if you can see it. Live.
Oh, that's sick.
Kind of triangular in their shape. So that's one of our set structures there. So you can see it. Wow. It's very, so the main entrance is through the doorway underneath the top platform.
Right there.
It's very industrial, much the same, but it's they look triangular. And the reason being is that, and they snake from offstage to onstage. So it never stops moving. There's always, and it's people coming from all different directions. And I think just by simply having a different playing space, you show your actors that this is their production of Jersey Boys. And, you know, they are not bound to any rules previously. They can do with it what they will, and they can completely create, because we've created a world that looks different for them. It's a lot more stripped back in terms of, you know, we've really gone for that somewhere between the original and somewhere between the Clint Eastwood film. It's very filmic. You know, we've been incredibly detailed with our props and with our costuming, and, you know, going and looking at reference materials of the original scene. What did they wear? You know, in terms of, you know, the classic, you know, so spoiler alert, there will be no cherry red jackets in our production. We go for the burgundy velvet because that's what they wore. They actually wore those.
Right.
Yeah. At the North Shore Music Theater in the United States, they also did blue for Sherry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just things like that to, you know, I'm a bit controversial in the way that I fight against audience expectations. So I did a production of Wizard of Oz years ago, and Dorothy didn't wear a blue gingham dress because it means pressure on the actress to be Judy Garland. You want to give your actors the best to be their own version of a character, and, you know, for them to truly create. Now, obviously, if they're stepping into an existing production, you know, like the Dodger production, completely different story. But for this one, we had the opportunity to completely to redesign. And from the set, you know, those were the early drawings. I've seen the set being built. It's just spectacular. And you know, it's going to be amazing. And those crossbars above the top, every time a sign flies in, it has a point of connection. So it looks like our bowling alley sign, for example. I'm not sure the dimensions of the original, but our bowling alley sign is 5.6 meters by 3.6 meters. So the size of a wall, pretty much. It's huge. Mm-hmm. So there's some giant pieces that we've got in the show that, you know, just, you know, and really conventional looks as well. So we don't have any lead elements, no lead screens. All of our lights are conventional lighting fixtures. We have two rigs in terms of our lighting. So we have a false rig, which is flown into view of the audience, so if you can imagine from the front, you'll have trussing that will fly, and it'll fly on an angle like that. So you'll see trussing that'll give it that'll tie together nicely with the set. And on those trusses will be, you know, old school conventional park hands, those big silver fixtures. So we'll get a lot of great light from those, and that'll tie together this era appropriate, you know, show that this look that we're going for. But and then above that, you'll have another rip with your moving lights and the rest. So things like that will just help us create this historically accurate world.
I have a question. So when, because I know we wanted, we'd love to know how you, you know, how you secured the rights for the show and everything, you know, for this, you know, for the second time around. I don't remember the name of the rights company that in Australia works with theatrical rights worldwide. But so when you, obviously, you know, when they brought the show to other countries, English speaking countries, they changed some things in the script. You know, Rick Ellis and Marshall Brickman, they made changes because a lot of these, you know,
just to make a little foreign more
audiences, yeah, yeah. They don't understand the New Jersey-centric specific lines.
Yeah.
So in the script that you get, do they give you the original script and then alternate lines because you're in a foreign country, or do you get just the original script? So I guess what we want to know is your experience with the rights and the licensing companies and that specific question about the script. Yeah.
So Origin Theatrical is the company that handles our rights in association with Theatrical Rights Worldwide, obviously. So you generally speaking, and again, this is a more of a producer problem than mine, but you know, generally speaking, there's, I think it's much the same with music as it is with anything. You have a percentage that you can change, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah.
So I know exactly the two parts you're speaking about. And they're both Tommies.
And the
London production uses those. You know, yeah, Jersey's great. Got some of the finest prisons
in the country.
Right.
And that's because obviously in England, we call a turnpike for you guys is a roundabout, right?
A turnpike is a kind of highway, actually.
Okay. Yeah. So yes. So those lines are things we're allowed to change, you know, because I believe the original, see, the funny thing is I'm Australian, but I haven't seen the original Australian production. In the US. So I haven't seen that Australian production, but I can assume it would follow the same rules as the original. In terms of what's written in our script, it's the same script that you guys would get over in the US. It's then they're not changed, those lines. But you know, you're constantly in discussion with the rights holders. So anytime you're unsure about something, you just ask the question, and most of the time they'll come back and they'll give you a pretty, you know, they have a list of rules and all of that. So, you know, they're more than willing to help you. And I think even more post COVID, they're more than willing to work with you and have those conversations. Of
course. Yeah. So does that percentage include changes in the set and the lighting and even the choreography?
No, that is kind of that's a blank canvas for us, you know.
Okay.
You know, as long as you don't tamper with the integrity, like if I took out Sherry, for example, not only would the audience want to destroy me, but you know, that becomes a big issue. But in terms of the redesign and the reinterpretation and the rebuilding of the characters and the way we cast it, that's completely at our discretion. So our cast is 15 on stage, one off. Okay. So we've got, you know, so it's a little bit different in terms of, obviously it's written and performed traditionally by 12.
Mm-hmm.
But we've also got an extra musician. So we have 11 in our band as opposed to 10. So, because we have a conductor who also adds additional percussion. So we've got an extra element of depth in terms of music as well, which is really cool. So, you know.
So is the conductor playing the keyboard and additional So he's not, no, so he's not,
he's
so
just he's, a conductor.
He's like stick, but also playing some percussion.
That's correct.
Wow.
So yeah, it's very cool. And because our musical director is, you know, his background is as a concert percussionist. Like he played percussion for Sinatra and for Whitney Houston and for, you know, some big heavy hitters. So, you know, to add those, like for example, and it's so funny because obviously the orchestrations are so lush and rich as it is, but you know, there's a couple of songs that, like, you know, like Oh What a Night is springing out at me, and same with Can't Take My Eyes Off of You. The there's bongos behind it in the, you know, and it's just like, it just adds this just an extra layer of depth. It's so subtle, but it you know, again, it helps create ownership of our production.
Can I ask a specific orchestration question that you might know the answer to? So you said the conductor is adding percussion. Yes. So this is such a niche question. The timpani hits right before Ragdoll.
When are we going to have a real timp? Is that what you're going to ask? Yeah. We are going to have a real timp.
That's sick.
Cool. Same with Beggin.
Oh, right.
So definitely this. The original production that I did was that keyboard patch with the timps, which sounded fine. Sure. But
which sounds fine, you know, yeah.
Live timp.
You see, that's the kind of niche we're going for. Is it going to be a live timpani or not?
I really wish we can come see this. Well, if you're recording it, please send us something.
Well, who knows? We may have a life beyond 2022. We'll see.
Hey, wow. Fingers crossed. Knock on wood. That'd be great. If you do, we'll definitely be there.
My hand to God.
Yes. So a question about how you are portraying Tommy this time and with your brand new cast. Mm-hmm. So your bio says that you have a very youthful energy to you, which of course we can definitely tell through this phone call. Now, when it comes to the portrayal of Tommy, in all honesty, I think I would rather have an underdeveloped Frankie than an underdeveloped Tommy, because like you need that right off the bat, and because that tone, you need it throughout the entire show.
And there's a spectrum of the kind of Tommy you can play, you know.
Right. So it can either be like that youthful Tommy, or more of that mob boss, that more toxic, like upfront toxic Tommy. So yeah. What do you plan on bringing to the role this time?
It's very interesting. Hey, and I really do, and I know I'm biased because I'm playing the guy, but I think Tommy is one of the most well-written characters in theater. I think he's just incredible. And I love characters on stage that portray our basic humanity, good and bad. And Tommy has moments of good, and he has a lot of moments of bad as well. I think that the common mistake for an actor stepping in to Tommy would be to play him as the bad guy. He's not. He's a guy that does bad things. But if you play him as a bad guy, you're not going to care about anything that happens within the show. So the first thing that I attempt to really sort out is the relationships that I have with the three other guys, particularly Frankie. If the audience don't believe that I love this boy, and he is like a brother to me, and that I will protect him, you know, especially in that first 43 pages, that's where my entire show as Tommy hinges on. The success of me in Act Two completely hinges on that first 43 pages and making the audience buy into the relationship that I have with Frankie and the kinship that we have. So, you know, I have to convince the audience that I love this guy. And it helps because I'm such a big fan of Bryn, and Bryn and I are, you know, we really do get along in that way, and we trust each other. And I think that does help. And, you know, same with setting up that dynamic between myself and Nick. Nick truly does have to live under my thumb for the entire first act. Otherwise, his eventual tirade doesn't mean anything. Same with Bob. I have to set up a position as the leader of the group, and really so be dominant in a way that, you know, dominant by necessity. I keep going back to that word necessity. Ooh, is the fact that he was what the group needed him to be, which was that lead from the chest and do what needs to be done. But you do occasionally see moments where he kind of drops it a little bit, and it's usually behind people's back when no one's watching. So I think setting up that power struggle between Tommy and Bob is really interesting, and having, you know, Bob eventually, you know, there's subtle little moments. You know, the first time that Bobby steps in front of Tommy to say, "I'll tell you what the problem is." That's a defining moment, because that's the first time Bobby takes leadership and Tommy doesn't like it. Exactly. And then you set, you know, the whole thing about the session, the money, here's your money. Well, nobody has to ask. Well, you know, that's that whole dynamic. And then eventually we get to scene 8. All of these little steps are so important in earning the scene 8 in act. That's if we don't set up all of those steps first, scene 8 is just played in straight anger and it means nothing. You know, I think by act 2, scene 8, straight off the beggin, the weight on the all four different weights, you know, but no, there's an exhaustion there. And I think playing the sense of, for me, at the end of this is a, and again, this is letting a little bit behind the curtain of what we're doing in this production. Stay for us, the first version, the first stay where, you know, Frankie says the loans, the taxes, we take it all. That scene is started from Tommy's in his chair. He's above him, like standing over him, saying the loans, the taxes, we take it all, looking directly at Tommy, so that we completely change the power dynamic. Whereas in act one and early in act two, Tommy stands over Frankie. Now here's Frankie. And there's no choreography in Stay, for the very reason that that whole first stay is just watching Tommy go. And the whole, the idea of stay, like, can we not just stay in this moment, remembering the better times that used to happen and things like that?
And if you're watching, you know it.
For me, as much as I'm hurt in that moment and kind of, you know, I'm pissed at Bob and I'm disappointed in Nick, I play that, the loans, the taxes, we take it all. My job here is done. Frankie's taken the lead. I'm proud of him in a sick way. There's like this sick pride that like I stand up and I'm like, you know, so you're all grown up. Well done, kid. You don't need me anymore. You know, I held it all together till we hit. And then I think Tommy in a way thinks my job here is done. You know, he was what the group needed, not necessarily what people wanted him to be. And that's how I'm playing it. I play this. I definitely, you know, he does some dastardly things. You know, he hits on Lorraine and I'm not backward and cover forwards. I really lay into that scene. And he is in a show without the typical antagonist. He is the most human and the most flawed of all four. But I think the way we play it is that all four of these guys are flawed. Tommy's just a little bit more, it's just a little bit clearer that Tommy is flawed. And you know, I think it's interesting playing it as the director of the show as well. And I think it is the perfect role to direct from, because he was in essence the director of the group for that right. First chunk. So here I am moving guys and telling them, okay, you move over here, we're gonna go here and here and here. And then in the show as Tommy, I'm doing the exact same thing. And it's fantastic, and it really does help set that precedent of Frankie's the lead singer, but Tommy's in charge. And that's kind of, you know, it's very fascinating.
Gia said the most brilliant thing a few weeks ago. We love the show because it's about four anti-heroes.
Yeah, in a way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is.
Four anti-heroes who are flawed.
Yeah. No, and Tom, thank you so much for giving us that sneak peek into how you're doing Stay. And you really are. I'm just so thankful that, you know, that you are so in tune with the show and with each character.
With the message and
and with Tommy specifically. I will admit, I never caught this until I finally saw the show again in person this year in November. I think the most telling scene for Tommy, like really seeing like that dominance by necessity, as you said, which I love, is when he comes back like, with the money, and then Bob Cruz says, "No, I got it. You know, it's fine. Like, my dad likes me." And then like when in that moment in his eyes, you can see him totally torn. And we've seen performances of Tommy either just go freaking crazy or you see him start to break.
Yeah.
And you know, so, and Nick always says that the beginning of the end was after
was you know, was way after way, that.
No,
was well, I mean way before was Well, I mean, after that,
yeah.
But before,
I think that is the beginning of the end for Tommy.
Yeah. And that Tommy, so in some ways,
I'm so curious how you'll play that part when he goes back and talks to everybody.
I play it as, you know, straight up fire in the, you know, nobody has to ask, the group needs money, I take care of it. And then there's a moment.
Yeah.
And then that's the hurt that, you know what, fine.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I don't want my money. I got other things. Yeah.
It hinges on the reaction of everyone who's sitting in Bob Crew's living room. It, like, that's definitely a defining moment for Tommy too. Like, mm-hmm. It hinges on that reaction. And then he knows he's at the, you know, in scene eight, he, right before he gets carted off, he knows he's at the end, right before Frankie asks him about, you know, what else. He's like, how many more hits do you think you're going to write? If I'm going down, you're going down with me.
Mm-hmm.
That's such, I the first time I really heard that line, I was like, wow, this guy's a, at this moment in time, he's a real shitbag.
It's fascinating. You know, the first time I played it, and I haven't decided yet if I want to go down this road again, if it's a little bit too on the nose, but we played Stay as a, you know, in that first bit of music before the vocals kick in, because there's a little bit of music before the thing starts. Tommy would stand, you know, as I said, with that same intention of, mm-hmm. you know, respect, Frankie, I'm proud of you. And he put his hand out for a handshake to say thank you. And Frankie would just, unable to accept it at that time, would walk past him and just kind of like, you know, no, not now. And then we played it as in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, when he says sorry about your daughter, Frankie, he puts the hand out again and it's finally accepted. So I don't know whether we'll go down that road again, but you know, that's certainly the, whether the handshake is there or not, that's certainly the intention, is that, you know, everything's broken, and then that sorry about your daughter is the olive branch, if you will. And you know, that's when we, and I think as well, when I come back in for the Hall of Fame, Tommy is not a healed man, but he's still Tommy, and he's still got that bravado, but I try to bring in a little bit of excitement as well. You know, all that other shit, the Oscars, the Emmys, you can get that anywhere, but you can't buy this. You know, I turn back to the stage, and you know, I let that, there's very few moments in the show where Tommy is actually genuinely excited about something. And I play that moment with pure, you know, passion and excitement, and you know, this is cool, and right. it's a really nice moment for Tommy, because he still has to be endearing to the audience, and he still has to be likable. He's the first one you meet, so you have to give the audience moments where he's a bit charming and likable. So that's a moment, especially coming right before his final monologue, which is after all the bad shit he's done. So that's really important to me, to just sprinkle a few of those really approachable and nice moments in there, so that you know the audience isn't completely turned off by him.
Everyone remembers it how they need to, right?
Exactly.
And that sums up the entire show. That's he sums up the entire show in that line, you know.
Yeah. And well I love that's such an interesting and I love perspective that,
because it's very much anything. Like
go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's just like Tommy's just like he says that everybody remembers it how they need to, right? It's almost like admitting to the audience, he's like, yeah, we've all told you our truth, but maybe none of them are actually true, you know. And it's like a little wink mm-hmm. at the end layer. It's the most Tommy thing to say. It's like, yeah, you know what I told you, maybe it's not true. And then he just kind of struts off, and that's you know, it's brilliant.
Peace.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And it takes him a lot for him just to do that, right?
It's a big admission.
Exactly. Absolutely. And I love your perspective and the idea of a second handshake. I think that's definitely interesting. Please let us know if you decide to go with it and if it works.
I will. I'm tossing up with it. And again, it's such a, these are the small moments that, again, there's no dialogue, there's nothing, but it just, they change everything. And, you know, something like that, there are so many moments that are paid off later. Mm-hmm. You know, the towel thing is paid off later, you know, there's so many of those moments that are paid off
book ending,
they're called,
as Ron Melrose likes to call it, the book ending.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are again, I think there needs to be peace at the end, and you know, it's, you know, for me to succeed as Tommy, I need to love the guys that I'm working with, and I do. So
good. Well, we're so glad. And well, so it's interesting because a lot of what we're talking about is what's in the abstract and what is interpreted over time in the show. So, you know, when, let's say, for example, in that scene when Tommy says, you know, if we need the money, I take care of it. Once that scene is over, you know, that's the only thing, like, so what does Tommy do with that money? You know, is that when he starts getting the apartments to put his girlfriends in, you know, all those little things. And so to further that kind of interpretation and that thought, we actually started creating candles that we're selling as part of our merchandise with Gianni Costanzo. Plug, he's our guy who does everything
Stage
for
Life
us.
Candle Co.
Yes. And so for our winter candle, we created one that's called Tommy's Party. And this was Dion's idea. And of course, it for people who want it just to be a light Christmas thing, it's, oh, what a night. Enjoy.
Maybe
Bob
have,
gets laid. Great.
Maybe they have a friend named Tommy. They're going to the party.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Everyone has a friend named Tommy. And we have a new one right now.
Exactly. And,
but also with, it really is kind of talking about that bittersweet, you know, kind of sad Christmas time, you know, when it's after the Hall of Fame induction, Tommy has his party, Frankie doesn't go. You know, I couldn't walk in, you know, I couldn't go in. Yeah. So what do you think is happening at that party, you know, in that meantime? Like, have you thought about that at all?
And does Tommy miss Frankie? Does he forget about Frankie? Does he give him the invitation and then not even think about him after?
Mm-hmm. Ooh, that's a really tough question. Hey, I think it's, I mean, the Italian-American side of things, I think it's a big party. It's a big soiree. There's going to be a lot of people there. I think Tommy's a great no-seller. He will be aware that Frankie isn't there and he'll be hurt by it because, you know, I think they're deeply emotional people, but he wouldn't sell it. He wouldn't react to it. He wouldn't make a big deal. You know, he'd kind of toss it off. And then I think as Tommy does, he'll have those moments later where, you know, but I think there's music. I think there's lots of food, of course. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's got to be a nice 12 year aged whiskey for Nick. You've got to have it,
of course.
I don't know what the original Tommy was a drink, what he liked to drink. I could imagine it would be in that whiskey or bourbon ilk. If it was me, it would be a bottle of Grey Goose personally.
Okay,
nice.
You got to get it. You just avoid over if you drink good stuff. I think it's certainly one of those things where it's crowded enough that most people might not notice, but I think Tommy's a lot more aware and a lot less ignorant than I think people probably realize. But I just think, again, by necessity, you just kind of shrug things off or you don't sell them because that's kind of what you have to do. You don't let people know you're hurt or you're scared or you're, you know, whatever. You just be what people expect of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's so interesting, you know, seeing all these stories from back then today, because they were all about expressing everything up, like the second it happens, you know, we're very much in that kind of culture now. But I think there is, we still do those things internally. But it's great for us to see what it was like back then and to kind of see what happens when, like, what are the repercussions when we do that to ourselves?
The strong and silent type, you know?
Exactly. Certainly. Yeah.
Gary Cooper.
And I think as well, there's an important PSA in there as well, is that that being that person can be very damaging to those around you, you know?
Exactly.
Tommy's story, at least in the, you know, the 1960s, didn't end well because... Mm-hmm. Maybe if he talked more, maybe if he, you know, communicated, maybe if he reached out, a lot of his issues could have been avoided. But, you know, I think that is an important PSA and you know, to play the, to, you know, really show the damages and not glorify it. I think I try not to glorify that stuff, you know. The gambling and stuff like that, you know, I'm aware that I'm performing it in a casino. But like, you don't want to make that seem that there does have to be a tinge of regret there. You can't just be like, yeah, well, whatever, you know, it's just what I did. And, you know, I think
not aspirational in a
exactly.
way. Yeah. So exactly. It's so interesting that you bring that up because I'm not sure if you've watched the new Sex and the City reboot and Just Like That.
I haven't gotten to it yet.
Okay, so no spoilers at all. But I was reading about Michael Patrick King, and yeah. So just don't do me a favor. Do not go on the Peloton Instagram. Just don't do it. That's where the spoiler is. Anyway, okay. So I was reading articles with Michael Patrick King, you know, the director and the creator of the show, and people were wondering, you know, about the girls, you know, are they still going to be like super rich, you know, because like that's not realistic. That's not something that you know, American girls should really be looking up to. And he's like, look, they're still the same. And in all honesty, that was a huge part of why the show is so attractive and popular, is because it is aspirational. And they say, you know, if it was absolutely aspirational, then it still is. And I think that's really great.
And it's kind of the same thing.
And you have offerings, exactly, that are not that as well. You know, for every Making a Murderer, there needs to be Care Bears.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. You know, you just need to have the balance. You know, we need to see the two extremes. And I think that taking it back to Tommy, is that's one thing I try to bring. I try to bring the extremes, the extreme love. It's red, right? Red colors throughout the whole show, but red is love as much as it is hate. And I think there needs to be, but you need to see both in order for the whole thing to work.
I agree.
For every Tommy DeVito, you need a handsome Hank.
Yep. And our handsome Hank is just, wow. The way we play Hank as like a pre-hippie. Like almost, like he's on the cutting edge. Like he would be one of the guys that eventually becomes a hippie. So
that's, you know, very.
So he's one of them that levitates the Pentagon.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, no, he's like a little bit like. Yeah,
wow! Okay, what a call! That's a great idea, Tom.
The same with Bob Crewe. Like we've got him on in every scene. We see him. He's probably 2 years ahead in terms of the fashion he wears. So like when we see him in,
I love that,
after Let's Hang On into Opus, he's like in a safari suit. You know, we see him like, you know, we see it, you know, so like
that's,
we see
amazing, him kind
of ahead of the curve in terms of, you know, what he'd be wearing, or, you know,
so he would. Ahead
of your time. You ever do Justin to make, there we go.
Mate, it was my first lead role in a musical.
Was
Joseph.
That was the second musical I ever did.
First time
was...
girls ever actually looked at me.
Oh! Hey, listen, Joseph is a sexy role, especially when you go shirtless.
It is. And
close every door. Come on. I mean, the
close every door. You get your spray tan on. You
shirtless.
Get
shirtless.
Your... I haven't seen it. I don't know.
I was shirtless up until Grovel. I was shirtless like the whole show.
Really?
It's from when they throw you in jail until
from Potiphar, because Potiphar's where you get stripped off, until after Stone the Crows.
That's true, right? Yeah. Because you're wearing that Pharaoh's outfit that goes over your bare skin, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Oh my God, that was the second musical I ever did, way back when I was. Fifth grade. So how old?
Ten
years old. That was the second musical I ever did.
Yeah.
Cute.
I missed my high school prom because I was the lead in Joseph. So
really?
And I was off. Yeah. So that was, you know, another one of those Troy Bolton moments.
Yeah. No soccer game. No prom. You're committed, man.
And that's it, man. Hey.
Absolutely.
I think this is a perfect place to wrap up, everyone. This has been another episode of Silhouettes JB Podcast.
All right, WandaVision. Okay.
Thank you very much to.
Yes. Oh my God.
Thomas Armstrong Robley, Tommy DeVito, and director of Jersey Boys at the Star Casino in Australia. Follow him on Instagram. Can you tell everyone your Instagram handle?
It is easy, at Armstrong Robley, R-O-B-L-E-Y, all one word, no hyphens, no capitals, no nothing, just Armstrong Robley on Instagram. Or you just look up my name, and I'm the only one. That's the easy thing, Armstrong Robley. There's no other Armstrong Robleys in the world, so it's easy.
That's it. And then also look up at Jersey Boys Musical, so you can find the official Instagram page of the production of Jersey Boys. Of course, follow us at SilhouettesJBPodcast_ on Facebook, Silhouettes JB Podcast. Find us on YouTube, Anchor. Thank you to Anchor for sponsoring us. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker.
All the places you can listen to podcasts and watch podcasts.
Please
like and subscribe, because like, you know, we have to say that in order
and
for it to work.
Get your tickets for Jersey Boys.
January 6th to the 16th, that we are putting the link in our bio, so you'll definitely be able to see it. And Thomas, really, thank you so much for your perspective. Thank you for your balls for implementing all of your ideas.
The ball's on you, man.
Seriously, you are giving us something to really talk about and different things to consider and bringing new life to Jersey Boys. I mean, really appreciate that. And I hope
thank you guys.
Yes. So please send
thank
us
you very photos. Much.